Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. When Vashti McCollum sued the Champaign School Board for offering religion classes for its students, she and her family became very unpopular around town. But ultimately, she won her case in a Supreme Court ruling that came out 65 years ago this week, a case that helped shape our modern understanding of the separation of church and state. Filmmaker Jay Rosenstein tells the story of the Vashti McCollum case in his documentary, The Lord is Not on Trial Here Today. WYLL hosted the film for its showing on PBS in 2011. It went on to win two Mid-America Emmys and a Peabody Award. To mark the anniversary of the McCollum ruling, there's a screening of The Lord is Not on Trial Here Today tonight on the University of Illinois campus. For our 8 p.m. Focus listeners, I'm afraid that news comes just a little too late. But for our morning listeners, that screening starts at 7 p.m. tonight, Thursday night, in the auditorium of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications on campus. Filmmaker Jay Rosenstein joins us in the studio for Focus today. He's associate professor of journalism at the U of I. And if you go to his website, jrosenstein.com, you can find out about his other films, including In Whose Honor, about Chief Illiniwek and other Native American-themed sports symbols and mascots, and the Amazon chorus Sing Out, about Champaign-Urbana's long-established lesbian feminist women's chorus. Professor Rosenstein, welcome to Focus.
Well, thank you. I should mention that I've been promoted. I'm a full professor now.
Okay. Have to fix that up here. Professor Rosenstein.
It was a lot of work. That's why I don't want to just let it slide.
Okay. Also joining us is Ken Paulson, president and CEO of the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and at the museum in Washington, D.C., and online at firstamendmentcenter.org. He'll be joining in a panel discussion during tonight's showing of The Lord It's Not on Trial Today. And Ken, I understand you were here at the U of I yourself on the air not a few years ago.
Oh, I spent some quality time on WPGU, and I spent the days when I was supposed to be at the law school at the Daily Illini, which explains why I am not a professor.
Okay. We welcome your questions and comments today on Focus at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Or you can share your descriptions, you can share your comments, that is, on Facebook or Twitter at Focus 580. This particular ruling concerned that the Vashti McCollum case resulted in concerned religion classes in schools, religions that were taught by outside instructors, not by people hired by the schools, but still in the schools. What was the big picture impact of this ruling when it came out?
The big picture impact. It caused quite a controversy at the time. But just as we look at it historically, I think the best way to describe it is if you embrace the idea that Thomas Jefferson had, that we have a wall of separation between church and state, then I would look at the McCollum ruling when it comes to public schools as being the first brick in the wall of separation. So that's why it's so important historically. This is the first case decided using that specific metaphor for interpreting the First Amendment, that there's a wall of separation between church and state.
And I guess from seeing the documentary, there was a ruling earlier that year on another case that used that phrase, but it did. It did not decide in the secularists' favor, and in the Vashti McCollum case, it did. There's something a little different about what was going on. What had the landscape been, the legal landscape been, up to that point?
Up until the
up until the McCollum ruling.
Well, you want to take that, Ken?
Well, sure, and it might be helpful probably just a bit of background. The McCollum case is all about whether a public school could release young people for religious instruction during the school day while their classmates who didn't participate sat nearby and would amount to a study hall. And so the question was, by providing that space and actually bringing religious teachers in and deciding, you know, the school superintendent decided if the religious teachers qualified. So that was the foundation. So it was a very important case because it was the first time they used the language of separation of church and state in a case. But what's critically important, and I love the suggestion of the first brick, that's exactly right, because a year earlier in Everson, a case in the Supreme Court, had begun to find that language, had begun to muse about the separation of church and state, and said unequivocally that that's what Jefferson, Madison, and the boys had in mind, that there would be but they didn't. It was like they weren't confident enough at that point. It was theory. It's potentially powerful theory, and they couldn't quite bring themselves to apply it in the Everson case, which had to do with reimbursing parents for the cost of sending their young kids to school, whether it was parochial or public schools. So the bottom line is McCollum was the first time the court really unleashed that theory and changed the path of American history from that point on.
And one big question that comes up, the First Amendment refers to what Congress should do. Was this the first ruling that said that the First Amendment refers to more than just Congress?
No, it wasn't the first. The 14th Amendment had been extended. Through the 14th Amendment, the Bill of Rights had already been extended to the states. But this was the first time they got knee-deep in the Establishment Clause.
Okay. The Everson ruling, the way you just described it a moment ago, it sounded similar to what's done today with school vouchers. Is there a comparison?
Oh, boy, that's a complex topic. I think in the case of transportation, because it simply was about giving them the tokens or the cost of climbing on a bus, that was so far removed from the teaching process that they just viewed it as sort of a public utility. I think the bus example is much more basic than a voucher question.
I think with the bus question, though, it was part of that ruling was that there was no advantage to religion by letting them ride the bus, whereas I think with vouchers you could easily claim that there is an advantage to the religious organizations.
I agree.
Okay. Going back to that phrase, Jefferson's phrase, a wall of separation between church and state, which is not in the Constitution, though some people may think it is. Do we know the context in which Jefferson said it? Was he making a formal argument? Was it a private, more informal letter? Do we know?
Well, it was a letter to the Baptists of Danbury, I guess reassuring them of the fact that that this new country was going to be inclusive of all kinds of religions. I guess you would say it's an informal thing. It certainly wasn't making it with the power of the government behind him as when he wrote that letter.
You know, one of the most hotly debated things is, would the founding fathers intend this to be a Christian nation? That is a question we have asked on the State of the First Amendment survey, which is done annually by the First Amendment Center. And a clear majority of Americans believe that this was intended to be a Christian nation. And I respect their point of view. I don't understand it, really. If you think about it, if it was intended this was going to be a Christian nation, you would think that the name of Jesus would show up somewhere on most important documents. You know, there's one reference to God in the Constitution, and it's a reference to in the year of our Lord. I mean, it's not, if in fact it was intended to be a Christian document and a Christian nation, there were lots of ways to address that in the Bill of Rights, in the Constitution, and it didn't happen. They steered clear of that very intentionally, and they understood what happened when the crown and religion became so firmly entangled. It's not a good thing for a free society.
Was it possible that it just seemed so overwhelmingly obvious at the time that it did not need, that the founding fathers did not feel it needed to be spelled out?
You know, you can make that argument, but you might also declare that, you know, freedom of speech was so obvious. And I mean, in those documents, you look at the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, those were our core beliefs. And everything that needed stating was stated. There'd be no question. This was the blueprint for a new nation. And I just can't believe it slipped their mind or they took it for granted.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about a court case that started with the McCollum family in Champaign, but which changed the nation's understanding of the separation of church and state. To find out more, we're talking with filmmaker and U of I full professor Jay Rosenstein, whose documentary The Lord Is Not on Trial here today won a Peabody Award for its telling on the McCollum story. And also with us is Ken Paulson of the First Amendment Center for some insights into the legal impact of the Supreme Court ruling handed down 65 years ago tomorrow. We welcome your questions and comments for our guests at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. The numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And, Jay, I wonder if I could ask you about the McCollum family themselves. Who were they? What type of people were they?
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm exactly an expert on the McCollum family, but who were they? They were a family, an academic family. Vashti's husband, John McCollum, was a professor in agriculture here, and they were just raising a family in Champaign-Urbana. There were three boys in the family. I don't know that they were particularly well known in any way until this case really exploded. And as Dan, Vashti's son and the former mayor, said, their address, 1118 West John, became the best-known address in the city. Of course, those were the days when newspapers actually printed your address when they were writing articles about things like that. I would hate to see that happen today, but... So I don't think there was anything particularly significant, and I don't mean that in a negative way if Dan's listening. I think they were just an average family here.
But they had very clear views when it came up to what was, I guess, referred to as the released time system of providing religious education at a public school.
Absolutely. And the biggest problem was the way in which Jim was ostracized because he happened to be the only one in his class that was not taking that religion class. And so I think the tipping point, to use that cliche a little bit, was when they didn't know what to do with him, so they stuck him out in the hall while the religion class was going on. And he's just sitting out there, which is where they usually put kids who are being punished. And so he got ridiculed and made fun of and ostracized. And when I think back about the story of the case and how easily it could have gone in a different direction, the first thing Vashti did, she didn't just jump out and sue. They didn't have the money to do that, for starters. She went to talk to the school, and she went to talk to the principal and the superintendent. And if they had not been, I guess, so arrogant about it, and so sure that what they were doing was right and they wouldn't compromise at all, she may have never gone all that way to finally sue the school board. So it's interesting to think if they had just been a little bit more accommodating to her, maybe this wouldn't have happened.
So this was a case where, if some things had gone just a little differently, it just never would have come up.
It's possible. I mean, I know where Ken's going. Something was going to come up. If it wasn't her, it would have been somewhere else. Why don't you take that, Ken?
I think what I love about Vashti's story and the story of her family is that I agree they were an absolutely normal, average American family, but they had an abnormally high level of social consciousness, and that ran, Vashti's father was an activist as well. And they saw very clearly the rightness and wrongness of things. But I do believe that this, just as the civil rights movement emerged slowly, case after case, if this hadn't happened in 1948, it would have happened in 1949. The Everson case guaranteed that. Mm-hmm. By developing that language, it basically invited plaintiffs, and this was going to happen one way or the other. And I love the fact that it came right out of the heart of the Midwest and changed the path of American history.
I'd like to play a clip from The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today at this point. And in this clip from the soundtrack, you'll hear Vashti McCollum and oldest son James, who was also at the center of the case, talking about their experiences at the time.
You see, this religious teacher moved right into their classroom. Anyone that wasn't taking a class had to get out. They had him sitting in the principal's office sometimes.
Well, they had to have some place to put me. And they had a desk out in the hall that they usually put kids that were troublesome. And so that's where they parked me. When Mom heard about it, things got a little testy.
It was when they put him in the hall. And that's usually assumed you're there for punishment. that he came home in tears. That wasn't like Jim. He said never again would he go to school on today's religious education. He just would stay home. I made up my mind, never again would he be put in the hall. That was it. No more religious education. We'd had it.
Well, at Dr. Howard School in particular, it was pretty hostile. And I had several fights and hassles. I remember one time they chased me all the way home.
He was beaten up more than once on the way home from school. He liked to go to the Y after school and do some swimming. They took his shoes away from him. He walked home in the snow without his shoes.
And that's a clip from the documentary film The Lord Is Not on Trial here today. We're here on Focus with Jay Rosenstein, the maker of the documentary, and with Ken Paulson of the First Amendment Center. And they will both be at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications on the U of I campus tonight, Thursday night at 7 p.m. in the auditorium for a screening of the documentary and also a panel discussion about the issues that case brought up. And you're hearing about it right now on Focus. Good morning. I'm Jim Meadows with Jay Rosenstein and Ken Paulson. I'm wondering, how did you first get interested in this topic?
Well, you know, I've lived here a long time, and as I've said before, this case was sort of, you know, floating in the air. It's, you know, one of those sort of cultural touchstones that I guess people who have been longtime residents here knew had occurred. I'm a little bit on the young side for it, of course. You know, I knew that there had been something there. And so when I decided to investigate, first of all, I had no idea if Vashti was even still alive or where she lived. I only knew that Dan was here. And so I had no idea how to find her. And I pulled out this thing that, well, my students don't really know exists anymore, but we used to call it a telephone book. and her, you know, she was listed in there, and I called the number, and she answered the phone. But for me, when I found out particularly that this was a separation of church and state case, that it had to do with religion in public schools, which was something that I already felt very passionate about. I was really hooked at that point. I knew that I was all in terms of doing the story.
And we should make it clear, if he didn't already know, that the reason that that Jay knew that Dan was here is that Daniel McCollum grew up to become a multi-term mayor of Champaign. Interesting in itself for a family whose name was Mudd in town, from what I gathered, when the case was a current event in the 1940s, for one of the people in the family to be elected mayor and be elected more than once, supposedly voted on by people who might have remembered the case and maybe wished the other side had won.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's sort of the ultimate irony. But, you know, Dan is sort of one of Champaign-Urbana's leading citizens now. So I think he managed, you know, by the force of his personality to turn things around as far as the acceptance of the family is concerned.
Vashti McCollum was the lead plaintiff in the case, not Mr. McCollum. And why was that?
Well, that's an interesting question. And, you know, the answer that I got from the family was simply that to John, Vashti took care of the family things, and so this kind of sort of fell under the umbrella of a family issue. But I also think a lot of it had to do with Vashti's personality, and she was a very outspoken, certainly not shy or retiring kind of woman, and very passionate about this. And from what I've heard, John was actually a very quiet, soft-spoken man. So part of it would probably had to do with her personality. She just had the kind of crusader personality that was necessary to take on a case like this.
And were there issues if John, he was a professor at the U of I, maybe not tenured, but the breadwinner in the family, maybe to protect his livelihood or at least an attempt to do so?
Well, you know, that thought occurred. I don't think it was central at the time. I don't know that the family knew how much backlash there was going to be. And his job was very much threatened, and his promotions were withheld for many, many years after the case had even been settled, before he finally got promoted for the first time. So it did really damage his career and hurt the family financially because of that.
This was once it became a case, I mean, perhaps beginning with the filing of the lawsuit, that's really when it went just from a thing that was going on in that school to something the whole town knew about. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it absolutely exploded, and it exploded nationally. This was a case that was compared to the Scopes trial at the time. And it was there was a media frenzy here, however, you know, a media frenzy is described in the 1940s. But it was here, and there were newspaper people from all over the country who were covering this.
And so did it become difficult for the family?
Well, it was horribly difficult for the family in so many ways. They were completely ostracized. Even friends of theirs were reluctant to speak to them anymore for fear that there'd be repercussions. And Vashti told me, you know, a lot of friends would sort of whisper to her, well, you know, I agree with you, but, you know, my husband works for the university. I don't want to, you know, jeopardize that. And so, you know, the family took a lot of abuse, both locally and in terms of nationally, in terms of, you know, I don't know if I'd classify it exactly as hate mail, but certainly some very negative mail and things like that. And the boys especially, both Dan and Jim really had to bear the brunt of it in school in terms of, you know, being beat up, being ostracized, all those things. And eventually the family decided that they had to send Jim away, that it was just so bad here, he probably wasn't going to survive. And they sent him to New York to live with his grandparents, really just for as a survival mechanism as much as anything else.
Okay. And that really points to different times, a different community than Champaign Urbana is today. Or do you think a case that was similarly controversial today would get that same sort of friction from the community?
Wow. That's a tough question. You know, you're talking to someone who stood up and opposed the greatest religious icon in Champaign-Urbana, which is Chief Illiniwek. And so, you know, I had a taste of what that kind of backlash would be. It wasn't as bad, I think, as what happened to Vashti. But I will say that for Native Americans who stood up against it, it was equally as bad. Now, Ken probably knows there's a history of these kind of religion cases. And the backlash to the plaintiffs were always really this bad. Isn't that true?
Yeah, and I wouldn't minimize what happened to the family, but you can trust that what happened to families in the Deep South who took a stand early on for civil rights, you know, were familiar with bombings and other things. So, you know, people who have taken a stand on principle have often faced a backlash. I did want to point something out, though, about Champaign in 1945 when this case emerged. Yes, once it became a controversy, you saw the ugly side of some people. But what's remarkable about this one is a lot of people implemented this plan in good faith, trying to do the right thing for children and the right thing for communities. And they weren't oblivious to the law. They knew that if a teacher, public teacher, delivered the religious instruction, that would be unconstitutional. They got it. They weren't ignorant. They understood it. And they tried very carefully to fashion a solution that involved all faiths, that didn't disrupt the school day, in their view, and that made sense for the community. They really tried hard to comply with the Constitution. So I think it's a mistake to sort of leave listeners with a sense that you know, there was kind of a lot of rednecks and angry people in this town. No, they really were trying to do the right thing. And then when it became a public controversy, yes, emotions run wild and people do and say things they shouldn't.
If perhaps something was different, were people who sided with the McCullums less willing or more fearful of speaking their minds?
I'm afraid I don't understand your question, Jim. Could you repeat that?
Well, the people who supported the McCullums, yes. Were they fearful of speaking their minds in support of the family?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And maybe in ways that would be different from today.
You know, it's That's a tough question. I will say, picking up on the thread that Ken brought up, one thing that I find really interesting about this case, and all the McCollum family expressed this, once the case was over, there really wasn't much backlash anymore. The community seemed to just accept it and move on in a way that a lot of controversial decisions, communities don't do that. And so really life really did go back to normal very quickly for the family. Jim came back here for high school and, sort of everything was fine.
Interesting. Well, I'm Jim Meadows and my guests are Jay Rosenstein and Ken Paulson. And the subject is a Supreme Court ruling on the First Amendment that had its roots in Champaign. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guests today are filmmaker Jay Rosenstein with the University of Illinois and Ken Paulson of the First Amendment Center. Jay's Peabody Award-winning documentary, The Lord Is Not on Trial Today, will be shown tonight at 7 p.m. at the U of I's National Center for Supercomputing Applications. It's about the case of Vashti McCollum and her difficult but successful court fight against religious instruction in public schools. And Ken Paulson will be part of a panel discussing the film and the case. Welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-5455. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can reach us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. The phone numbers again are 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Jay, I was wondering about the film title. Could you tell the story where the title, The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today, came from?
Sure. As it happened, the first day of the trial, apparently a man with a Bible under his arm, a local resident, came to the courthouse and rushed up to John Franklin, who was the attorney for the school board, and announced to him that he's come to testify for the Lord. And Franklin looked at him and said, "The Lord, sir, is not on trial here today." And I should mention that Dan McCollum wrote a book using that very similar title. It's not exactly the same. And Dan was gracious enough to allow me to essentially steal that title and use it for my film as well. So I want to make clear that I stole from Dan. Dan didn't steal from me.
And perhaps both sides wanted to make it clear that the Lord wasn't on trial, but I think the McCollum family also wanted them, and they had to make their art for their legal arguments work, to make it clear that this wasn't a persecution of religion to end these classes in the
schools. Yeah, absolutely. They tried that, but apparently the original attorney who was hired for Vashti by a group called the Chicago Action Council, which was made up of a number of Chicago area lawyers who had split off from the ACLU at the time. And so that attorney actually basically ran the case in a way that the McCollum family were very unhappy and actually did in many ways antagonize religious people in the community in a way that wasn't necessary. And Vashti was really furious about it. And after the trial ended, she immediately fired him.
And then appealed.
Absolutely. And appealed. And for her, the big question was, who are they going to get to represent them? Particularly because I think she felt that they had struck out, and this was kind of their last chance. If they didn't find somebody to really represent them correctly, they were going to be in trouble. And they managed to find this elderly man named Walter Dodd, who had been a constitutional law professor, and he was basically semi or totally retired and agreed to take this case, I think, because he really enjoyed the intellectual challenge of it as much as anything else. And so he really became one of the heroes.
Maybe we can talk now. When you're making a case, you have to make a case to a court which may just simply have a different understanding of the of how the world works than you, but you're both working with the same constitution. What sort of argument do you make here? And I don't know if this is a question for you, Jay, or for Ken.
Ken, why don't you?
Well, I think that's really a case by case. In the end, the Bill of Rights rules, and some of the most historic cases, some of the ones that have changed literally the path of American history, come down to the most basic things. And in this case, I think there was a wise focus on the child, and the impact on him. This in an environment in which a lot of people are Christians and, you know, feel like giving Christian education to young people is a good thing. It's kind of hard to make the case that it hurts a child to have that experience, and that was part of the debate and discussion. A lot of the discussion surrounding the McCollum case had to do with addressing juvenile delinquency. This was just a couple years before the James Dean movies and Rebel Without a Cause, and, you know, there was great anxiety in the post-war generation about what would happen to young people. So I think wisely they made the case that what was occurring was causing irreparable damage to certain young people who were sent out to the hallway. You know, I think any legal argument that at its base has a foundation of the Bill of Rights and makes a case in sympathetic terms that an American citizen is being mistreated, that typically has the most resonance, especially if the facts back it up. And in McCollum case, it certainly did.
And what sort of legal arguments from the other side then did the lawyers in the McCollum case have to refute in order to convince a court?
Well, I'll say briefly, you know, what Ken said earlier was that the school board really did try to create a program that they thought would pass constitutional muster. And a big part of that was the idea that these classes would be voluntary. And I think that was one of the key points in the original ruling in the original circuit court, was that these classes were voluntary, so that you weren't compelled to participate at all. That's the one that stands out in my mind. Do you have any?
No, I think that's the case. I mean, the question was any real harm done to the student? And the argument was, yeah, sure, he's in the hallway, but it's study hall. He's actually benefiting from that experience as well. And I think that in the end, though, it came down to, can a public school, can the government use some of its resources in a way that enhances, increases, escalates the teaching of religion in a public setting? And the answer is no.
And I gather part of the things that the other side across the table from the McCollums would have found what they thought in their favor was that the program did offer a choice of religious instruction, essentially Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish. I don't know if there were different flavors of Protestant church instruction being offered at the time in the program.
No, and it's actually interesting just to look at that aspect right today as well, that, of course, there's only three choices for religion. You're Protestant, Catholic, or Jewish. What else could there possibly be?
One thing that occurred to me in your documentary, you do show, I believe you account a Unitarian Universalist minister, which that may have been the church that the McCollums actually attended.
Yes.
Testifying on their behalf to apparently disastrous consequences in the trial. And that does bring to mind, actually, the Universalist Unitarians have been in Champaign-Urbana for a long time, but apparently they were not part of this program.
No, not at all. And the Unitarian Church, the Unitarian minister, was really turned out to be Vashti's key supporter throughout this entire case. And, you know, yes, his testimony was controversial. I would say it was more like the cherry on top of the sundae. It was already going in that direction, and he sort of maybe put it over the edge.
You know, one of the interesting things, and Jay may be able to cite what publication this was, but there was a newspaper editorial after the case, or maybe during the height of the case, out of Washington, D.C., that said 100 years ago this would have been a valid concern. Or, you know, and they were talking literally about the founding of the nation. They just were not very good at math. And they were saying there was a time when religions actually were oppressed and really were discriminated against. But that's all done now. We basically the three religions get along very well. And then you fast forward to, post 9/11 America and the reaction to Muslim Americans. I mean, discrimination on the basis of religion has never gone away, and that's why decisions like this one in 1948 remain important.
And, you know, we should point out that these kind of violations still go on today. And, in fact, there are, I just read in this last night, there's a school board area in Texas which are literally doing the exact same thing that was happening here in Champaign. The problem being, of course, that the Supreme Court, has no means to enforce their laws. And unless you can get a local person, a local state's attorney to support it, these things really do go on. And as Ken was saying about the juvenile delinquency argument, of course, that hasn't gone anywhere either. You saw that in the recent shootings, the recent school shootings, the first thing out of the mouth of Mike Huckabee and Newt Gingrich is, oh, well, it's because we don't have prayer in school anymore.
I'm wondering, I looked at the newspaper clippings. You used a lot of newspaper clippings in the documentary to give an idea of the media climate at the time.
It was all I had visually, by the way.
Was there any? Now, it could be a question of just a choice of what works best, but also if you could get hold of it, was there any, for instance, any newsreel coverage?
No. There was absolutely no moving images of any kind that were germane to the story, including home movies from the McCollum family. There were none.
Our radio broadcasts that may have been recorded.
Radio, I don't know. I didn't look into that. Again, you know, the issue is film is a visual medium, and you know, you really have to, you've got to be able to plug all those black spaces with pictures. Mm-hmm. And the audio portion was always the easiest thing, but video was a huge, huge challenge for this. You know, local TV didn't come to Champaign-Urbana, I think, until the early 50s. So it was really a blank slate in terms of a visual palette for doing this story. And that kept me awake a lot of nights. I was wondering if I would be able to get through it.
Well, I was struck because with a few people helping out, it's really the people who are telling the story are Vashti McCollum and James and Dan McCollum. I think they're the primary voices. I was impressed. You note in the documentary that Vashti died in 2006. So in this documentary aired on PBS around 2011. So you must have taken a while working on the piece.
Yes, it was about 5 years.
Where was Vashti McCollum living in her final days?
She was living here in the Inman Center. Mm-hmm. The Inman in downtown Champaign, and I went and visited her in her apartment, shot some footage there, and that's where she was until she passed away.
Even though she's very frail, I thought she was very sure of what she wanted to say, I take it.
Oh, absolutely. And she said something in the film that Dan said she really said for the rest of her life, which was this quote that, "I knew I was right. I knew I was right." And she said that for the rest of her life.
When I was talking about the newspaper clippings on the documentary, I noticed a byline I saw more than once, and that was Georgie Sokolsky. And I think I had heard from other accounts of this that he really had a burr up his behind about this case. Was that your understanding?
You know, I never researched him, but from reading those clips, I would say that it was very clear what his take was. I think he was maybe, you know, in an early, I don't know, George Will kind of columnist or something of that.
I was wondering about that because I went online. I found one of his columns about this case. And Georgie Sokolsky was a syndicated columnist. He also had a radio show at one point sponsored by the National Association of Manufacturers. He was an ardent anti-communist. And it's interesting, the column I found, I think, was published, I guess, after the trial had been conducted, the first trial, but before the verdict came out. And I think Sokolsky was trying to make the best argument, summing up argument that he could as he saw things for keeping the religious instruction going. And the two things that he saw the issue pivoting on was, in his words, one, the right of the parents to control the education and culture of a child, and two, the place of religious education in American life, which he saw as being primary. And his argument goes on to make that this country was founded principally by religious exiles, and its institutions and traditions are a product of the Christian religion, as its ethics are rooted in the Old Testament. Few peoples have in modern times taken their religion as seriously as the Americans, who, in spite of modernization and higher criticism, are devoted not only to their faiths, but are so conscious of the minutiae of religious dogma and doctrine that they continue to split into fractions and particles of church organizations. I believe he saw this as a sign of strength rather than simply a sign of division. He also makes the comment, I think, pitting this as essentially one set of ideas versus irreligious and Marxist ideas, among other things. But goes on to say that, and he counts 1,850 communities and towns which had some sort of religious instruction in their public schools. Mrs. Vashti McCollum's suit, as Ed Borman of the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette points out, writes, Sikorski may result in the discontinuance of these programs, and it is this fact which makes her suit of such moment, and his final word, she may succeed in destroying a valuable phase of the cultural training of the American child. And I take it that's what the McCollums had to argue against in court. I don't know if that's quite the legal argument, but that must have been the sentiment of the times.
Well, I think Ken has a bunch to say about that. Let me just say that in the final ruling, in Felix Frankfurter's opinion, he also has very strong opinions about the place of public school in American society. And he saw it in a slightly different way, that the public school was the place where all Americans would come together and learn to be united and learn to live with one another. And he felt just the opposite, that this sort of thing was actually taking a public school that was a place to be united and dividing it.
I enjoy doing this with Jay because he can sense when I'm coiled. By the way, I just want to say this before it gets away from us. This is an amazing documentary. Everyone should come out and see this and catch it online and wherever you possibly can. What I do for a living is actually go out and remind Americans of how important the five freedoms of the First Amendment are. We're nonpartisan. We're nonpolitical. We just basically say the First Amendment is a very good thing, and we need to remember that every single day. And this documentary does it so well. It tells a story so well, and it moves the audience in a way that reminds you that the Bill of Rights is a living thing. I wanted to follow up. What you read there was not just the tenor of the times in 1948 and 52, whenever it was written. It's a tenor of today, and you hear the same sort of thing, that religion in the schools is character building. We are lost without it. And when, as Jay points out, there is a school shooting, people say it's because God has been driven out of our public schools. Let's be very clear. God is still all over our schools and all over our society. You know, in sharp contrast to actually my childhood, today students can form Bible study classes and meet after school. They can carry their Quran and their Bible to classes with them. They can wear jewelry that reflects their faith. They can wear T-shirts that reflect their faith. They can gather in front of the school with faculty members, with their gym teacher, with their coach, before school, 10 minutes before school or whatever, around the flagpole. They can hold hands. They can pray together. There are very few limits on individual, personal, religious expression in America, and including public schools. God is alive and well in America's public schools. What the courts have said is not, God, get out of this public school. They've said, government employees, if you're paid by the taxpayer, who may have a variety, they clearly have a variety of faiths, you cannot take advantage of your position as an employee in a public school to impart your faith. Those are the rules, and it's pretty basic fairness. And it always boggles my mind when we see a case where people are angry because the coach couldn't begin a prayer with the football team. If he had pulled out a Quran, everyone in that town would understand exactly why the rule is in place.
And we have a call, a patient caller.
Thank you.
I hope they're still there. Well, here we are. And Jeff, calling from on the road. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hey, good morning. Good show as usual. Guys are right on the topics. You know, somebody brought up the fact about God. I think I forget who it was, but God in schools. And I say, I don't even think it's God in schools. I think it's the fact that what you're getting in schools, I think, has a big influence on you, like whether it's God or not. I think. But my big thing is, you know, I think some of the curriculum has been changed over the years. And not for the good. I mean, I was reading something on how we're not getting a lot of people in school anymore that wants to study for, you know, be mathematicians or be a engineer because, well, one is it's hard. Math is hard. And you know, number two, it takes a lot of knowledge and a lot of time spent getting to be in a, you know, like, say, working at NASA as an electronics or, you know, a NASA space engineer. And I think what's happening is there's all these curriculums being added that aren't as necessary. You know, it used to be the three, what was it, reading, writing, arithmetic. They don't focus on it anymore. A little bit of history. I mean, I'm 56, and it's some of the stuff I see in these schools nowadays, and it's not religion. I mean, in fact, it's more sex-oriented, which I think is kind of really dumb. And I honestly believe, you know, as far as the God issue, it's, that should be brought up at home, not in the schools, in history of the world.
So, Jeff, are you saying that in terms of religion, that's something for home as well?
I think, if anything, it should be taught in at home more than I do, because I never had that when I was in high school. In the 70s, so, you know, from 60s, 70s, the 80s, they didn't really, it wasn't a God issue. It was learning about the world. It was learning about how, you know, Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia, how they function in the past to the future, you know, to the present. And you know, South America, North America, and how their cultures evolve. And it wasn't a religious thing that was added to it. I don't know where the God thing came out. I mean, and I don't have a problem. I'm religious, okay? So I don't have a problem in having a, say, a religious form in school, if you want to. I think that everybody should, it should be fair game for everybody to have what they want in school when they want it. The problem is there's people out there who want to twist it around and say, well, you can't have this unless I have this. And then they're using it. And that's not what school is for. School is for learning, reading, writing, and arithmetic and getting the tools that you need to go on to college, bigger, better things.
Okay, Jeff. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
And that brings up a question. After this ruling and other rulings like the ruling on prayer in schools that came some years after that, did that have a real effect on the religion's place in American public schools? And has that kept up as the decades have passed by, or have things changed in other directions?
I think we need to – are you saying did the McCollum case endure?
The McCollum case and maybe other and maybe other rulings as well.
Well, McCollum was undercut a few years later by something called the Zorek case.
And quickly, could you tell me about that?
Basically, it was the same model as the McCollum case, mm-hmm. except they sent the kids out to religious instruction off the campus.
But still on school time.
On school time, yes. But no other school participation, no funding. And in the 50s, the Supreme Court kind of backed off of McCollum just a bit and declared that that was okay. I think most of us would view that decision as sort of just a loss of nerve a few years after McCollum. And what it comes down to today and sort of the result of McCollum is that any significant entanglement between a public body, a public school, its administrators, teachers, or staff, or location, and organized religion or disorganized religion is prohibited under the Constitution. So McCollum set the tone. The court moved up and down in various ways. There were permutations, but Engel, the big prayer case, Vitale versus Engel, these were cases that refined the thinking, but the core principle remained. There's a separation of church and state.
One thing I'm wondering, I'm going to shift gears entirely here to Jay, because after watching this documentary, The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today, I'm wondering if you're working on something right now.
That's everybody's favorite question. And the answer is, I'm working on raising my children primarily right now.
I can't wait to see the movie that comes out of that. But I don't know if you have a camera handy at all times.
Well, I do, but we'll see. I don't know where that's going to go.
Well, I am afraid we are out of time now. This is Focus on WILL. Jay Rosenstein is professor of journalism at the University of Illinois. Ken Paulson is president and CEO of the First Amendment Center. Jay's documentary, The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today, will be screened this evening, Thursday evening at 7 p.m. at the U of I's National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And Ken will be on a panel tonight to discuss the film and the McCollum ruling. Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. Just go to will.illinois.edu/focus. And if you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus who lives outside our listening area, well, we stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu. You can also listen back to years of past Focus programs. And we're also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up again, visit the Focus page of our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Lawn and garden care on tomorrow's show. Yes, underneath the snow that fell this week, plants are waiting to come back to life. And Sandy Mason, horticulture educator with the U of I Extension, is ready to take your questions. That's tomorrow on Focus. Today's program was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of the Focus team, Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.